All right, Luke 22, we'll pick up in verse 31. Simon, Simon, behold, Satan demanded to have you, or to sift you, though he might sift you like wheat, but I have prayed for you that your faith may not fail. And when you have turned again, strengthen your brothers. Peter said to him, Lord, I am ready to go with you, both to prison and to death. But Jesus said, I tell you, Peter, the rooster will not crow this day until you deny three times that you know me. Satan has sought to sift you. Help us now, Lord, as we come to the scriptures. Let my thoughts really reflect you well. It's almost impossible to paint this glorious picture of such an eternal, omnipotent, all-powerful God. But let the word, the seed, fall on good hearts. And may we craft an ongoing journey of transformation, as Jackson so wonderfully said. Amen. On the TV screen is a picture. Probably my most favorite artist, Vincent van Gogh, or Van Gogh, as Americans say. I'm Afrikaans, so Afrikaans is a Dutch derelict. It's Gogh, Vincent van Gogh. And it's a very moving picture, I'm sure you agree. It was painted or etched at a particularly interesting time in his life. But I'd like to know what you see. Both the medium, what did he use? What did he paint on? What was his subject matter? And what do you think the moment was that he was crafting? Open question. There are no right or wrong answers.
Charcoal?
Say again?
Charcoal?
What else? What else can you see? You don't have to be clever. You can just see. I'm not clever. I can just see.
Despair?
Why do you say there's despair?
Well, the man is hiding his face. He's crunched over. It's like it looks like he's got heaviness on him.
Yeah.
His posture.
His posture, Eddie?
Yeah, I think that he's in anguish. I think that he's wrestling with life and doubts and fears.
Yeah. Yeah. Grief. Okay.
His fists are clenched instead of an open hand.
That's good, Chris. Yeah. What does that signify to you? What do you think that means as a man?
Basically, something that's out of your control.
Something burning behind him.
Something burning. Yeah, there is a fireplace. Which is in itself interesting, I think. Sorry? Yeah, that's right. The fire's gone out. It's smoldering. It's not nearly as raging as it could be.
Lonely.
Thanks, Sam. Yeah. Yeah. What else? Yeah.
I think the fact that with that he's on a chair, if he was totally beaten down, whatever is overcome him to be on the ground.
That's good.
Yeah.
That's good. You ever thought of that?
Unlike his other images, there's no color in it.
No color. Very good.
Yeah.
He prided himself in very bold colors. Great observation. When I was in the Vincent van Gogh Museum in Amsterdam, it was probably one of the most moving things of my life. You kind of go to the paintings and they got a little speech for you about each one. And I was deeply moved by many of the pieces. And I chose this one today because, as you'll see in a moment, hopefully it'll fit into the context. He was a pastor. I don't know how many of you know that he was. And he went and ministered to the coal mining community, a desperately poor community, very broken community. In fact, they pulled him from the pastorate because he was so immersed in the pain and the light and the brokenness of this coal mining community, which is why I think he used the charcoal. I think it reflected a time where he probably saw that on some regular basis. He saw the plight and the brokenness of that. I think, thank you, the fire's gone out. It's interesting, about 8 years later, he did a painting that was not dissimilar to that. I think it's called Eternity's Gate. It was just bright in color, similar posture, similar painting, but bright in color. And I find this piece incredibly moving. I find it incredibly empowering, and I want to know the story, don't you?
Yeah.
I want to know what's going on, what's happened that's brought him to this place of despair. He titled it Worn Out. I think it was painted in 82, I think it was. He died 8 years later. I sat with one of you over this past week, which is why I changed tonight's message and conversation. And you asked me about a particular situation in your life and to help you find and make sense of it. And tonight's conversation or talk really is, and I want to leave time for worship because it really sets itself up for some intimate desire and encounter with Christ, was how we make sense of a moment in this person's life three ways. You know, as I listened to this young man tell his story and of a particular moment in his life, not dissimilar to that actually, I said to him, and he asked me the question, is this his story, which for reasons of confidence I won't tell, is that a dark night of the soul? Dark Night of the Soul was written by St. John of the Cross in Spain, a mystic, a Spanish mystic, who wrote a series of poems. I'll quote from one of them in just a moment, and we will talk just briefly about that. It's a beautiful subject. But I said to this young man, I think we have to understand three aspects of our lives, and I hope tonight will help. The first is this. Times and seasons. You know, in Ecclesiastes, and those of you older like I am, the folk music, there's a time under heaven for everything. There's a time to be born, a time to die. And then they sing from Ecclesiastes 3 about seasons. You know, that's one of the most important things all of us need to be reminded of. Let me explain it this way. Times are the meta-narrative of our lives. We're born and we die. And in between, we're chopped up into chapters where God gets us to live chapters of our lives. I was born in a blue-collar work family. My father was a boilermaker, so he wasn't an educated man. My mother was not educated. But that was a chapter of my life till I was about 12. We were in Afrikaans community. 13, we moved to another city, into another language. So English is my second language. Afrikaans is my mother tongue. That's the second chapter of my life. Then I went through high school, of course, the college, the army, and teaching and the rest of it. All of our lives have these pieces that make up chapters, day by day, week by week, moment by moment, step by step. They are great meta-narrative of your life. The great comfort that God goes before us, the great assurance that He crafts our steps. And I don't know about you, I am so deeply grateful in the sovereign nature of God, who is the overriding, prevailing drone, if you wish, of my life, crafted up into those chapters. However, the seasons are that within every chapter of your life and mine, we will go through all four seasons. Oftentimes, when we first step into whatever the season looks like, I'll give a few examples in a moment, it's invariably through the door of summer. Not always, but invariably it is. It feels good. It's exciting. It's exhilarating. We're inspired by it. We want to tell everyone. When I met Meryl, she was a 15-year-old cutie. And I was pretty stoked about this. And then when we got married, when she was 18, that was, and then I left to go to the army, which is another story. But within that narrative, within those chapters, come these seasons. And here's the guarantee. In that, take a freshman at college. You arrive, the buzz, the excitement, the awkwardness, the vulnerability, the uncertainty. You feel so big, and yet you feel so small on the inside. You feel like you're an adult, but you kind of still want to hang with your folks. It's this uncertainty that's inside of you that's buzzing all of the time. The clock ticks, and summer becomes the fall, and the fall becomes winter. And in winter, the leaves come off the trees. And we despair oftentimes thinking, but I thought this was so good. Maybe I married the wrong guy. Maybe I shouldn't have gone to this college. Maybe I should have had another career. Maybe I shouldn't, whatever the case may be. And it's in the winter that some of the deepest and most sublime work of God gets done in our hearts. We live in a frothy theological world where we're supposed to be happy, look good, smile all the time, be trim, as if we are an endless summer, like the surfing movie did way back in the 60s. But that's not the narrative of our great and wondrous story. Our story, every chapter, you will come in here and think, this is a cool community. Oh, this is cool, cool space. We eat together, we hang out, we do music, whatever the case would be. And then it's like, geez, Chris irritates the hell out of me. I just think he's shut up sometimes, you know. And so you go through the prickles of the leaves falling off and all the little thorns beginning to squeak their way through. And then the deep, dark winter, and we don't understand winter in California. We have to go to Minnesota, don't we? To understand what winter really is and the brutality of it. And one day we look and through the snow peeps this little beautiful tree, this little twig. And the twig has leaves and there's little flowers squeezing through the asphalt as if life, new life is beginning. And then we breathe a sigh of relief. Oh God, how great you are. I want to empower you to understand winter is not a time to cop out, bail out, forget, move on, find a new home, do something else. Winter is a time, in South Africa, the bushfires burn in winter. And it's commonplace in South Africa to see hills go, not brutally like happened recently in the Santa Barbara area, but the hills of Africa burning. And it's as if we all celebrate together because we know without that burning, there will be no little green leaves, green shoots that will begin to break through and the new trees that begin to peep their heads above the canvas of God's nature. I want you, dear friends, to understand that. I want you to know that though the fig tree does not blossom, we can praise God. He is worthy of our praise. Does that make sense to you? It doesn't matter what your chapter is the simplicity of my statement. You will go through all four seasons. Posture yourselves. Get a wardrobe ready. I went to Utah with Todd Proctor, a group of his friends. We went skiing. Now, Africa has no snow, so I'm probably not going to learn to snow ski anytime soon. So I was the designated driver, and one of the guys got hurt on the slope, so I had to go and take them to ER. But I just sat there. I was saying to someone early on, I just sat there writing while they were skiing, and it was this ever-moving canvas of beauty before me, just as the wafts of snow came across the window. And then they would pause, and the sun would peep out, and then the wind would pick up, and it was just this endless creativity. It was just absolutely exquisite. Winter is magnificent if we let it be. It's when God removes the flab of summer and streamlines us for tenacity and guts and fortitude that only winter can offer. Are you with me?
Yes.
There's a second understanding of those dark moments of our lives, and that's the passage I read to you, where Satan seeks to sift you all. Great alliteration. What does that mean? Well, I want to argue a few things here. I want to say, firstly, the devil hovers around like a roaring lion, seeking whom he can devour. We know that. And this is what he wants to do. He wants to disrupt your Jesus journey. He hovers. He's like that hyena that I told you about the other night. He's just waiting. He's just hanging, waiting for his moment. And he'll come in and he'll forage and he'll grab one. You know, the word sift means to separate. And one of my pains as a father and as a spiritual father, mentor, director, pastor, carer person, is watching people get sifted as if that verse does not occur in the Bible. So easily, so readily. The enemy comes in, he just waits. And then either guilt, shame, or fear, the three things that he uses most readily, guilt because I have sinned, shame because what if people find out, fear because I don't know if God will keep loving me. He keeps holding us to those three. And then he just comes in and he nabs and he runs and he forages and he eats and he comes back and he nabs and he runs. What I said to the congregation, remember you guys last Sunday, was no matter what happens, run to church, run to community, not a building, not a service, not a gathering, run to community. What does he do? He disrupts our Jesus journey. He distracts us from our calling. Oh, he loves that. My brother called me when he was 38. The age of 18, he was 18, I was 22. No, he was 19, I was 20, whatever. And I was preaching my heart out one Sunday. He was in the congregation like this. And he came forward. I preached the message at him, unapologetically. Love my brother to bits. He is a wild, radical rugby player who will experiment with everything and commit to nothing. And he walked forward that night and he knelt like in front of me like this. And I grabbed his head and we're a very robust family. And I put his head in my chest like this and I prayed for him. And I was weeping with gratitude. And he walked out there and he ran. For 20 years he ran. For 20 years, moral failure, adultery. I mean, I can just go on and on and on with the list. My heart was broken. Lost years, lost time, lost moments. When he was 38, 20 years later, he called me. We were already living here. And he said, "But I've come home. I've come home." He said, "I know this. I cannot rebuild my 20 years, but I can start afresh." And he has. It's a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful story. Satan looked at my brother's calling and he said, "I'll wait for the right opportunity. I'll wait for the moment." And he found it. A little blonde teaching with my brother. Thank you. That was the moment. Satan seeks to separate. Why? So he can rob you of the things that are exquisite about life and life's meaning for you. He will destroy our God confidence and our self-confidence. And he will disease our relationships. I just played with some D's there because I like it. Caleb teases me about that all the time. I want you to understand and to sniff it. I want you to be able to sniff the hyena. There was a young boy who was camping and they didn't zip the tent up well enough. The lions will come past and they won't enter the tent. They won't try. They'll rub up against it, but they won't squeeze in. But they left a gap this big because it was cold and they thought, well, if we need to go to the toilet, we'll just kind of lean out the door and do it. And the hyena came in and took the boy's head, dragged him out. And he survived, traumatically survived. But what he said he could not cast aside was the smell of the hyena. It wasn't even the grab or the bite. It was the smell of the hyena. My dear friends, I would love for you to be able to smell the hyena. To know when he is trying to separate you from your calling, from your gift, from your relationships, from the confidence that God has given you. It's interesting. Are you still with me?
Yeah.
I'm not going to be much longer. He says this. Jesus says, he said, "I'm praying for you, Peter. One, that your faith will not fail you." And in those times, dear friends, when doubt is the raging voice that penetrates your soul day after day after day in unmitigating tenacity, then Christ is praying for our faith not to fail. All of us do. I do. Walking with Jesus 40 years, I do. If I do, you do. He says that you will turn back from the drift that happens when the enemy comes to flirt with us, so that you will strengthen your brothers. Those dark moments, when are they? The first is when we are in that winter season. You've got to ride out the storm. With love and intimacy, you've got to ride out the storm. The second is when Satan seeks to separate you, and obviously we can talk much about that. I want to speak about the third one quickly. The phrase is the dark night of the soul. I think it comes from Psalm 23. "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. Though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for thou art with me." St. John of the Cross in the 16th century wrote this dark night of the soul, and I love this. It's quite challenging, but I love it. He says, "O you guiding night, O you night more kindly than the dawn, O you night that unite lover and the beloved with the lover transformed." He coined the phrase, the dark night of the soul. That's interesting to me as I've been researching that, how it crosses the span of philosophical and psychological thinking. Thomas Merton, the 20th century monk, speaks of the dark night of the soul as spiritual inertia, inner confusion, coldness, lack of confidence. So you've got a Catholic, you've got one of the New Agers who I stumbled onto. He said the dark night of the soul is a term that goes back a long time. Yes, it does, 16th century. Yes, I have experienced it. It's a term used to describe what one would call a collapse of a perceived meaning of life. An eruption in your life of a deep sense of meaninglessness. The inner state, in some cases, is very close to what is conventionally called depression. Nothing makes sense anymore. There's no purpose to anything. Something is triggered by an external event. But the Protestants have it. John Bloom, interesting article he wrote. He said, it took no time for the void of God when he entered the dark night of the soul to produce the void of meaning. The vanity, emptiness, and striving after the wind that the preacher proclaimed I understood as never before. Work appeared meaningless. Rest appeared meaningless. Leisure appeared meaningless. The cosmos appeared meaningless. Life appeared meaningless. The hopelessness, and that to me is the picture, of all the existential philosophers describe, raged through me. I cannot capture in words the depths of despair I experienced. For months, I had a constant low-grade headache from the dissonance of conflicting beliefs in my head. I won't quote the rest of it. It's quite fascinating. You know why I wanted to bring this in? Because we'll all go through it. Mine was 2006 for about a decade. Up until that point in time, to be brutally honest with you, Merrill, sitting there, I was the young preacher, had the big church, the fastest growing church. I was flying around the world preaching, and as if God one day said, it's time. And I knew this was not going to be good. And it began. But I am incredibly grateful for that time. It was a dark time. It was a tough time. It was a brutal time. I wrote here, it's a God-authored chapter of your life. It seems like all the primary purposes are stripped away. False self and scaffolding that we grow to depend upon, and all hindrances of intimacy with the Father is removed. You know what we can't understand? Can I just speak from my heart for a moment? How much God loves us and how important that love is more than anything else. We honestly think he finds great pleasure in our religion and ritual. We think he is stoked by us reproducing religious behavior, vocabulary, and ideas. And he just smiles and says, well, then I think God is way more compelled with the intimate heartbeat of our love for him and the transformation that it brings. When I was a young guy, man, I wanted the biggest church in town. I wanted my name on lights. I wanted to be known. I'm embarrassed to say all that. I've just written a blog on that. I'm so brutally embarrassed by all that. Because the longer you walk with him, the more you realize he just wants you. Me. He just wants Chris. He's going to have eternity with me and I with him. And what a glorious, glorious sense. And so what he does in the dark night of the soul is he strips away everything that we grow to depend on and create importance in. Our spouse, it doesn't mean we get divorced, but our spouse, our profile, our job, our dignity, our clothing, our dress, our home, things that we hold identity. God says, I'll deal with that, I'll have that, I'll have that, I'll have that. Until he finds the raw, naked you and me. And it's in that dark night of the soul where St. John says, where the beloved and the lover unite. We'll go through a full range of emotions. I remember one afternoon, I lay in Diamond Bar. We lived in Diamond Bar at the time. And I remember lying in our ensuite bathroom floor. I remember lying in the fetal position like this. Now, remember, I'm a pretty strong guy. I'm an Afrikaner. I mean, I'm a soldier. I'm whatever, whatever. And I remember lying there. The only thing I could utter was, you are sovereign. You are sovereign. You are sovereign. That's all. And nothing more to say. Shortly after that, a young man took me to the airport. I was flying somewhere. And we were talking about this time. And he said to me, Chris, what did you learn about God during all of that? And I said, you know what? I learned that God is good. And I heard my mouth say that, and I thought, How can you connect these dots? But I realized in those dark moments when God stripped away everything that I depended on, everything that I wanted to build my life around, as those things fell, so the sweetness and the beauty and the kindness and the forgiveness and the redemption of God squeaked through, and I saw him for who he really is. My point is these stumbling steps we have, and we'll have to do a whole thing on that at a later stage. These stumbling steps we all have. Let's pause and say, God, is that simply the winter for this chapter of my life? And if it is, I will knuckle down. Is it because Satan is seeking to sift me? And if it is, I will run to community. I will engage with those who love me and stand with me and protect me and hold me. And if it's that dark night of the soul where darkness seems to prevail, my every thought, my every moment, meaninglessness cries from my inner belly as I find myself lonely, isolated, abandoned, but I find him who is the true lover of my soul. As we discern those moments, it's an exquisite chapter of our lives. You are young, you look at me sometimes with intrigue, I'm sure. But you'll know it when it happens. It's like falling in love, you'll know it. You'll know it. When I looked across the room at Meryl, I knew it. I called her, declared my undying love. And the only thing I didn't say that night was, I'm going to marry you. Because I think I would have chased that little 15-year-old girl right out the door. Bye-bye. When you close your eyes with me, if you don't mind. Can the band come and join us? We're going to worship God together. There's something exquisite about winters. When the land is stripped away and God allows us to experience seemingly the depravity and desperation of the world in which we live. Then the spring comes. And I want to say to you, if you're experiencing that kind of wild wilderness winter right now, this is a good time. Though the fig tree does not blossom and there's no fruit on the vine, yet will I praise thee, oh my God. And learning to worship when nothing inside of you feels like it. Not an ounce, not a thought, not an emotion, not a mood, not a hand. But you pick yourself up and say, God, this is a winter moment and I will praise thee, oh my God. When the enemy seeks to separate or sift you and me, that we don't surrender and submit for isolation and abandonment, but we push in and find comfort and strength in our brothers and sisters. And then that dark night of the soul, when it comes, you'll know. But it will not be a time of fear, but a time of faith. It will not be a time of anxiety, but a time of embrace. And you will know the sweet, sweet voice of Jesus above the din of everything that seeks to shut him down. I hope that helps. I just thought it would be wonderful for us to worship him. Would you mind standing?